supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Former President Barack Obama has endorsed 81 Democratic candidates for public office across the country, and that includes 7 from our region. WHYY's Dave Davies reports this leaves many wondering why some Democratic hopefuls in competitive races were not endorsed.
Montgomery County Congressional candidate Madeline Dean, running in a relatively safe Democratic district, got the president's endorsement. Scott Wallace, running in a very competitive Bucks County race, didn't. Obama didn't give a detailed explanation of his picks in a statement announcing the choices. To understand the process, you could ask one of those who got the endorsement, like Bucks County State Senate candidate Tina Davis. Did she ask for this? Was she vetted? How did she make the cut?
Well, this sounds ridiculous, but I did not know I was getting endorsed.
Really?
It's pretty funny. I was at a meeting, and I got a text from a number that I didn't recognize.
A day later, Davis still had no idea who'd recommended her or how the president made his picks. She's one of 5 Pennsylvania candidates who made the cut. All are women, 2 are congressional candidates, and 3, including Davis, are running for the state legislature. Congressional candidate Andy Kim is one of only 2 who made the list from New Jersey. Though he served in the Obama and Bush administrations, this came out of the blue.
I found out when I saw on Twitter that people were circulating around that I got endorsed by President Obama.
Veteran Democratic consultant Mark Nevin says the president's endorsement can help with fundraising and boost turnout among core Democratic voters. Does not making the list mean a Democratic candidate is being snubbed?
No, usually these kinds of endorsements come in waves, so I would be surprised if this was the last we heard from President Obama.
A spokeswoman for Obama says there will be a second wave of endorsements before the election and that Obama will campaign in several states this fall. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Princeton University is hosting artists and scholars from Puerto Rico who can't work at home because of damage from Hurricane Maria. While more than 10 months after the devastating storm, University of Puerto Rico buildings are damaged, libraries are moldy, and much of the island is still without power. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that some scholars are spending a few weeks at Princeton to catch up on their work.
Alfonso Fuentes is a music composer who teaches in San Juan at the Puerto Rico Conservatory of Music, but he lives outside the city, up in the mountains.
I am surrounded of marvelous night insects who sing all the time. One of the reasons that I am there is because of that sound. I love that sound in the night.
When Hurricane Maria hit last September, the trees lost all their leaves. Puerto Rico was basically deforested. The verdant green island turned brown and turned very quiet. There's no birds, no insects, no wind in the leaves. Fuentes had never heard anything like that, a quiet forest, and it deeply saddened him. He began to write an ode to fallen trees.
And I made it without thinking, you know. It was a communication with my inner heart. No intellectual thought, just my inner thought.
You're hearing a preliminary performance of Ode to Fallen Trees from earlier this summer. The piece is supposed to be fully orchestrated, and it was supposed to have premiered last April in China, but Fuentes has not been able to finish it. Most of his time and energy is spent on the basics of living, like food, power, transportation, leaving little time to write music.
This is a great opportunity for us. I have a studio 24 hours. I got new friends, which is very important to me.
Princeton University has many opportunities for visiting artists and scholars, but this new Visiting Scholars and Artists from Puerto Rico program, or VISAPUR, was created to be more nimble and responsive, with a faster and looser application process and no teaching demands. Princeton invited 13 scholars to spend a few weeks at the campus in New Jersey. Marla Perez Lugo of the University of Puerto Rico is on a multidisciplinary team thinking about the future of the island's electrical grid. It was destroyed by the hurricane. She's a sociologist and says rebuilding the electrical grid is both a technical challenge and a socio-political challenge.
It has a physical layer that is composed by the post and the cables and the generators. It also has a cultural layer, attitudes, beliefs, values that influence our behavior. It also has an institutional layer.
There's going to be blood. There's going to be a fight. And it's going to be mainly a political fight, determining the future transition in terms of electricity for Puerto Rico.
That is Perez Lugo's husband, Cecilio Garcia. He's a political scientist. Together, they co-founded the National Institute for Energy and Island Sustainability at the University of Puerto Rico. They plan a book about the socio-political history of electricity in Puerto Rico from the 19th century microgrids built privately on sugar plantations to 20th century public mismanagement, to current ideas about rebuilding the broken grid with environmentally sustainable power.
I'm particularly interested in how narratives of power dominate the way we are rebuilding the grid. Those narratives are mythical sometimes, like we are a blank canvas, a blank slate. So that's absolutely not true. There's a society there that's already there. There's no blank slate.
Garcia says being in Princeton allows him to not only temporarily escape the turmoil of living on the island right now, but build relationships with scholars in other disciplines. That's something not available to them at the University of Puerto Rico. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
The Philadelphia Trans Wellness Conference is underway today and runs through Saturday at the Mazzoni Center. Let's learn more with Dane Menken, the center's clinical operations director and nurse practitioner. Dane, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
The Mazzoni has always been the sponsor of this event. First, describe the work of the Mazzoni Center.
So the Mazzoni Center is an LGBT health center that is multidisciplinary in the services that are offered. The health center itself is about a 13,000 patient practice. And we serve currently somewhere around the neighborhood of 3,000 transgender and gender nonconforming folks.
This conference annually in Philadelphia is the largest such conference in the world.
It is the largest conference of this type in the world. And one of the things that makes it continue to grow is that it is free to all people that attend.
What year is this?
This is the 17th year.
Are you bringing your nurse practitioner awareness to bear on one of the focuses this year being what providers need to know to care for trans patients?
Yeah, I've been a presenter at the conference many times and feel passionately about presenting for sort of what people affectionately like to call transgender 101 care. So it is the information that primary care providers and specialty providers, if they're interested, things they need to know to provide competent, excellent health care to folks that are transgender and gender nonconforming.
Transgender 101 care, should one infer from that that there's still an inordinate need to create this understanding from the ground floor?
We're seeing fewer and fewer folks, which is great news, that need that very fundamental kind of education in this region. But I'm very well aware that that's not the case around the country, that there still is a great need for providers for this kind of care, people that can do this kind of medicine competently.
If we were to look at the map, are there only a few regions, the Philadelphia area included, where these kinds of services are, in your estimation, adequately provided?
They're limited, yeah. They're generally in the larger urban areas, which makes access for people not in those urban areas like Chicago and New York and Boston and on the West Coast in the larger cities. So if you're not fortunate enough to live in one of those larger urban areas, your access may be quite limited.
There will be, again, panels during the presentations. And with that, let's bring in panelist Alexander Chen, Equal Justice Works Fellow at the National Center for Lesbian Rights. Alexander, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
And we need to bring politics into the mix. And this is the Trump administration. And I'm wondering the extent to which that acts as a deterrent to expanding recognition of and services for the trans population.
So certainly, the administration has undertaken a number of actions which are not positive for the transgender community.
For example?
Well, including, for example, the administration's attempt to ban transgender people from serving in the military. The administration has also rolled back Obama-era protections that were issued by the Department of Justice and the Department of Education protecting transgender students. And the Department of Justice has also rolled back protections for transgender workers. The list goes on.
And I understand you're specifically involved with two suits to try to redress that.
Correct. We are representing plaintiffs, both active service members and aspiring service members, in two lawsuits against the Trump administration, one in California and one in the District of Columbia. And in both of those cases, we have won preliminary rulings from those district courts in which the administration has been enjoined from enforcing the ban while the lawsuit is going on. Transgender people can continue to serve and can continue to join the military.
Do you have cause for optimism that the causes you're advocating for will be realized anytime soon?
I personally have a lot of optimism. It is my personal view that law is not what causes social change, that law is a handmaiden to social change, and that judges are human beings and politicians are human beings, and they react to what we see around us in society. And what we see around us in society is a movement where transgender people are coming out of the shadows, and they're showing that we are really just the same as everybody else, and we deserve to be treated equally and with the same respect as everybody else, and that our society is all the richer for it when we treat everybody with that equality. And I believe that that cultural change is going to continue to be for the better, even if we are facing some political headwinds at the moment.
But Dane, some might say that optimism is met in turn by what is increasingly regarded as an increasingly tribal society, where we each retreat into our comfort zones and are less and less tolerant of others.
I have a lot of optimism and faith around the younger generation, because this separation and this lack of tolerance is a problem for grown-ups. This is not a problem for kids and teenagers.
And I would say that, you know, I think the hardest thing about being LGBT is also the source of our greatest strength, right? The hardest thing, I think, is that we don't grow up in families that are LGBT. I'm also, you know, Chinese American. And, you know, one of the benefits of being an ethnic minority is that even if you did face discrimination, you have your family there to kind of teach you about it and talk to you about it and sort of guide you along the way of how do you navigate that. But as LGBT people, we are usually born into families that are not LGBT. And we, as a result, I think sometimes face a tremendous isolation, but also have this amazing opportunity to cross these cultural divides and cross these political and, you know, regional divides, right? Trans people are born into every kind of family, in every kind of state, in urban areas, in rural areas, in communities of color, in communities of faith. And that gives us that opportunity to bridge some of these tribal divisions that you're talking about on a personal level.
Dane, Alex, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The Philadelphia Trans Wellness Conference is underway. It runs through Saturday. I've been speaking with Dane Menken, Clinical Operations Director at the Mazzoni Center and Nurse Practitioner, and Alexander Chen, Equal Justice Works Fellow at the National Center for Lesbian Rights. While many Pennsylvania municipalities struggle to sustain their downtowns and shrinking populations, the State College area faces a different set of challenges. As Keystone Crossroads contributor Ann Danahy reports, the place that's home to Penn State is seeing growth, but not everyone thinks it's the right kind.
Ron Madrid is standing in his front yard a few blocks from downtown State College. He motions to the houses and apartments in the neighborhood.
When people take care of their property because they own it, that's much different than if you're just renting. Walk down the street and you can say, rental, rental, rental. Somebody lives there, you know, owner-occupied rental.
Over time, neighborhoods like Madrid's have seen shifts from long-term residents to more student rentals. Downtown, State College is seeing a boom in new apartment buildings. That growth troubles some residents. They worry it will change the character of the town. Madrid was president of his neighborhood association for many years and ran for mayor. He served on the planning commission when State College adopted changes to its zoning that allowed for taller buildings.
It's not as simple as people say, well, I don't like high-rise development. I gotcha. Not many people do, especially here in central Pennsylvania. But if we wanted to redevelop downtown, that's the price we paid.
In recent years, redevelopment has taken off. Slick, tall apartment buildings with names like the Metropolitan have been built or are going up around the edge of downtown.
We're going to see a dramatic transition over really a 5 to 6 year time frame, where we'll have gone from being historically undersupplied to probably now having some vacancy rate and more units than we're used to as a region.
State College Planning Director Edley Clear says the borough looked at where it wanted to grow. In the end, it chose higher density development around the edge of downtown while preserving the heart of town. He says if you don't redevelop the town's core so it's an attractive, vibrant place and bring people in,
then eventually you will stagnate to the point where you don't have enough tax revenue.
The redevelopment includes 12-story buildings with high-end apartments for students and space for businesses and shops. Some residents think State College should focus more on making the town an affordable, desirable place for families to live. Mark Hunsick is president of the Highland Civic Association. He says one of the reasons his family moved to State College is the walkability, including walking their daughter to school every day. The Highlands neighborhood is next to downtown, and Hunsick and others feel the effects of its growth.
It's not just a matter of them coming in and creating a living space for the students. I think that there needs to be a realization of that impact on the neighboring communities. And we're, as the Highlands goes, we're right there. We're right next to it.
Susan Vinagoni is vice president of the association. She says working families have a hard time affording the borough.
I think diversity is really important. And if we're constantly moving in one single direction, it'll be more like dorms, less like a neighborhood.
Eric White has lived in the neighborhood since 1976. He says portraying longtime residents like they don't want any change isn't fair.
All the research that I read on the sustainability of neighborhoods is about maintaining home ownership in the neighborhoods, that the neighborhoods that are most viable on the whole as the kind of neighborhoods we want are neighborhoods where there's a substantial number of people who own their homes and take care of them. We have that to a certain extent here, but we're starting to lose it.
Penn State enrollment has been steady lately, but it's still a major driver of these changes. Jonathan Friedman, an attorney in downtown real estate, says after the recession, hospitality and housing grew. Interest rates dropped, more money was available, and it had to go somewhere.
Student housing became a hot commodity because of the ability to be positioned close to campuses and rent to students.
At the same time, the demand for student housing outstripped the supply.
I don't think there's ever plans for people to tear down all of State College and build high-rises everywhere. But I think that smart control growth is important.
He says student housing can be an engine to push the community's ideas forward. Commercial space is required on two floors of new apartment buildings in the higher density development area. Friedman says the community can voice its opinion about what it would like to see there, certain stores, restaurants, or offices.
Utilizing that gives us all an opportunity to make the town better.
With the development going on, the number of housing units in State College is expected to increase about 20%, and largely, they'll be downtown student rentals. For Keystone Crossroads, I'm Ann Danahy.
It's equal parts competition and camaraderie when the third annual Philadelphia International Unity Cup soccer tournament gets underway tomorrow. Comprised of 52 teams from neighborhoods across the city, let's kick off the conversation with Nea Whaley, coach of South Philadelphia's Liberian team. Nea, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations. You coached the winning team in last year's tournament.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
It's going to be tougher this year with new teams aboard. Are most of the players returning to your team?
Yes, most of my players returning to my team. Yes, sir.
How did you get involved in the tournament?
Well, 2 years ago, I was informed on the internet that the city was about to have a Unity Cup, which is like World Cup for the city of Philadelphia. And then I called, got the information, went downtown to City Hall. That's how I found out about the Unity Cup.
Was it incumbent upon you to then put together your team?
Yeah, it was me and a few other guys. We were like three people, Paul Cornett, myself, and Coach Milton.
Are you a player coach?
No, I'm just a coach. I don't play anymore.
Does the Liberian team hail from all over the city, or is there a particular neighborhood where you mostly draw from?
From a particular neighborhood, which is the Southwest Philadelphia neighborhood.
And again, it was a couple of years ago when you first heard about it, and that was probably during the inception of this event that was envisioned by then-Mayor Kenney as a way to include and celebrate Philadelphia's immigrant community through a shared love of soccer. So, yes, it's competition, but to what extent do you also get along with members of other teams, either during the tournament or throughout the year?
Yeah, actually, you know, during the tournament, after the tournament, we have made a few friends from different countries, people I would never get to meet, in Jamaica, Brazil, Argentina. We actually stayed in contact during the off season.
I suppose that was even easier this past year with the World Cup.
Yes. Yes. We even got to watch the World Cup with a couple of guys from different countries.
What was your rooting interest in the World Cup?
I was actually rooting for my team is Brazil.
Now, what's going to happen if you face off in Brazil in this tournament?
Well, I'm going to be rooting for myself, for Team Liberia.
This tournament, which gets underway tomorrow, doesn't conclude until the middle of October. How many rounds or how many games might you have to play to emerge?
For each round, the quarterfinal round, we get to play three games. It's 4 teams in a group. It's 2 teams qualified from the qualifying round from the group stage. So you got to win about 7 games to win the championship.
Now, like in other sports, were you seeded at the top because of your record last year, or was it just a draw to get into the tournament?
No, I was actually seeded at 19th, because my first game of last year, I lost the game. So, you know, I had to come back strong.
You know, they've legalized sports gambling. Who do you think Las Vegas is picking to go all the way this time?
Las Vegas is picking Liberia to go all the way.
Well, then my money's on Liberia as well. Good luck to you, and thank you so much for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you, sir.
Nea Whaley, coach of South Philadelphia's Liberian team. The Unity Cup soccer tournament gets underway tomorrow in Philadelphia. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. If you think the New York Times crossword puzzle is tough, you're not alone, and they get even tougher as the week goes on. Monday puzzles are the easiest, but by the weekend...
when we get all the way to Saturday, then the puzzle maker and the cluers are actually actively trying to mislead you from getting the answer because they want it to be really hard.
Now that's New York Times digital puzzles editor and Philadelphia native Joel Faliano. We'll be speaking with him about the craft of crossword puzzles on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.